Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What's good, internet? It is June 5th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. We're coming to you live from Lobby 1. It's the afternoon. Normally, we do it in the morning, but it's the afternoon today. I'm your host, Austin Walker. Joining me, Danielle Riendo.
Hi. How you doing?
Patrick Klepek.
Patrick has something on his mind.
And coming to us from a room in Los Angeles covered in actual pillows, Rob Zachney.
Not just pillows. I've also strategically placed packages of paper towels and toilet paper around the room as baffling.
Yeah, baffle. You got to baffle what you can.
High tech.
Patrick, you seem pensive.
I'm trying to find out if you can, if the website for Goatsea, which don't look, do not, if you don't know what that is, stay pure. Do not look it up.
No,
I think you should look it up.
How old are you?
I think you should look up the Wikipedia page for it. There's a long history. Also, didn't Gizmodo do like a long profile of the guy?
Like an oral history of Goatsea?
Well, not oral history.
Yeah, it's a slightly different end of the body. Yeah.
No, they like interviewed the guy, I think. Anyway, I'm trying to find out if Goatsea is still up without going to the website.
I don't mind doing the research. I'll take one for the team.
Somebody has to.
You got a new phone.
Somebody has to have made the website. Is goatseestilllive.com. Like that website has to.
Go to
I'm going there now.
Like, is it up? Like the website that lets you check.
Well, it might be up, but I mean, like it could. Like it says here on the Wikipedia page. At one point, it was in 2011. It was forwarding to a web hosting company.
Goatsea.
Also, as of January 2014,
you know what? I'm gonna open a private browser. Open link in incognito window.
I'm looking. It's loading.
It says they're preparing to launch their own cryptocurrency, the Goatsea coin.
Safari cannot open the page because the server cannot be found.
Goatsea.cx is offering subdomains on Goatsea.cx. You can do virtually anything you want with a Goatsea subdomain, just like a normal domain. Host your web page, blog, resume, or IRC server.
Yes! Finally!
So can we get
IRC
Waypoint
server has a home!
Waypointirc.goatsea.cx.
External links, come on.
I checked. We're good. It's not. We live in a different world. Why are you? What? Patrick? How did we get here?
There's an article I just put up on Waypoint about like a really good top-down shooter called a Tormentor X or Cross Punisher. This really interesting, unique, really fascinating mechanics. And one of the screenshots of that game, which is at the top of the story, has some hands that appear to be in the position and opening a circular hole that is part of the transition that occurs when you die and you respawn into the game. Now, that alone, okay, like, mildly interesting reference to an old internet meme that at this point, like, we live in an age in which I've outlived me, or, like, there are generational gaps in memes. There are people that don't know what Goatsea is.
Yes.
But Danica tweeted out one of our conversations about realizing what this is, and then someone responded to them with an apparent quote from the developers in a Steam forum post in which someone asks Dr. Bile Duct, great name.
Oh,
It says, "No ring. Please put a ring on the right hand in the first screenshot. Thanks in advance." In which the developer then replies, "Okay," like a very confused okay, and then Dr. Bile Duct, being the doctor that he is, the expert that he is, says, "Thank you, I really appreciate it." And then Johnny Fronthole,
a great name here,
says, "Do you mean a ring on the hand on the right side of the screen, or on the right hand of the entity creating the opening, which would be on the left of
that's
the screen?"
That's very
the
good entity. Point. The entity known as Goatsea.
Okay.
which then Dr. Bile Duct, again, noted expert, follows up with a confirmation of the former, because we are inside looking out.
Aren't we all? 2017, we are inside ghosts.
Goddamn right.
So what I want to find out is, and I don't know the answer to this, but as you know, a reporter that takes their job extremely seriously and wants to get the inside scoop.
Well,
way inside scoop, yeah.
You think about that one? You've been sitting on that?
Sitting on it? Yes.
Might not want to sit on it. That's got its own problems. I want to find out if that was intentional, because the idea – if it's intentional, I don't care. If it is unintentional and that now people are projecting Goatsy onto this game, I find that to be profoundly funny.
I really like the notion that it's one artist who snuck it
in.
Yes. Like an old artist, too. He's like 37 years old and like – I've been in this game for 18 years. I've been making games since I was a teenager. None of you kids know my old memes. You're all your new memes, all your I will protect him bullshit.
He was mad about the Sonic one that was about the thought, and he wanted to go back to a good old meme that was way better.
Wholesome memes.
Say it. That's what happened.
What's this game? What is the game? Wait. Not the game. We're talking about Goatsy. Not the game.
Right, Descartes.
We're not talking about the game.
Descartes, Goatsy.
We're talking about Goatsy. That's another old meme that people don't know, probably. It's an Allen Iverson meme. Patrick, what is the game?
It's a top-down shooter.
One more time, the name, Tormentor X Punisher?
Tormentor Cross Punisher. You'll find it looking with an actual X, so Tormentor X. Punisher. It's on the PC right now, although they've expressed intentions of having it ported elsewhere. It's a pretty small studio, from what I understand. It's a top-down shooter, which, like, when I loaded it up, I was like, do I really need to play, like, another one of these games? Like, I've played a lot of these. It has some really inventive mechanics. Like, for example, your two weapons that you have exclusively are a shotgun and a machine gun. The shotgun has, I think, 6 bullets or like 8 bullets, small amount of bullets. The last one always has a fire trail to it. So it's like if you don't want to necessarily reload at all times because you might want to get that streak of fire, but then you run the risk of then like running out of bullets right when you need them. In order to reload, you don't hit a reload button. You fire your shotgun, which is your other weapon, and so your shotgun acts as the reloading mechanic for your machine gun, and so you're constantly swapping between those two, which sort of like determine the flow of combat. In addition to that, the upgrading system is really fascinating, where it doesn't explain how to upgrade your weapons. It is completely oblique and something you learn about as you're playing the game. Whereas, like, when you'll do certain types of kills, like, for example, if you have a bullet ricochet off of a wall, you'll all of a sudden see this meter pop up that says, like, Wally, and then, like, as you do more of that, that meter starts filling in further. Like, there's another one where if you get an enemy to kill another enemy, I think it's called Thank You, and, like, that meter starts to fill up. And, like, those meters are what upgrade your weapons, and it forces you to then approach combat in, like, highly specific and situational ways based on, like, the enemy formations you have, like, how much space you have between enemies, like, the types of enemies that are coming in, forcing you to, like, to play the game in different ways in order to upgrade. And it just makes each run really fascinating and different because, like, you might want to, you know, maybe you have a certain upgrade path you like to do, but that's just not happening right now based on, like, the enemies that are spawning in.
Right.
And then because you're finding it out as you go along, it makes it really interesting because you'll trigger one of the meters and have no idea why you did it. And so then there's a lot of fun experimentation in, like, just doing weird shit in the game to try and get one of them to trigger and then to try and figure out what exactly triggered it so that you can repeat it and try and continue up the upgrade path. So that's like, as you become more familiar with just the general flow of the systems, you're also becoming more familiar with sort of like the depth that comes from the upgrade system.
Yeah, I feel like I've played a bunch of top-down shooters that are like very straightforward in terms of like what their progression is or like, oh, it's a power-up I pick up, like Crimson Land or something like that. And it's neat that this sounds like there's like a little, there's some like, not secrets necessarily, but like, I guess it's a little bit like secrets to kind of stumble into. And I like that. That sounds cool.
It's a neat game.
Yeah, it's from Raw Fury and they kind of haven't made anything. They've made Bonner and Kingdom.
They're publishing.
They're like a tiny indie publisher.
But yeah, Kingdom, really cool strategy game. Yeah. I know Rob and you both have talked about that at length, right?
Yeah.
I have like a weird relationship with Kingdom, but it consumed about 40 hours of my life that I mostly didn't regret.
Rob, that's I never heard a person write say a Steam review out loud, but that's like 40 hours. I have a weird relationship with this game. That's it.
Well, it was 40 hours out of like 70. That's where things went wrong.
I see.
So you needed to put another 30 in to like win, or you needed to?
It's really at least at launch, it was really difficult to win Kingdom. And it was like Kingdom was like, yo, you just need to fling everything you've got at this like unkillable boss for hours. Mm. And it's possible that the level layout might just like mostly make that impossible. At which point you're just going to have to start over again and try again.
I will say that I like the name Kingdom a lot. I played Kingdom. Kingdom is cool. I didn't beat it. I probably put 5 hours into it, not 40. But I love your phrase of like, in order to win Kingdom. It makes it sound like a game
Unless
that was played by
Kingdom.
By kings and queens and like or monks or something.
Yes.
I love it. It's really
so I'm like various kind of like to win Kingdom you must send wave after wave of bullshit.
It's like saying read law.
Right.
You know, like it's a very British way of saying you studied something. I've read
Rob
law.
Fury also I think had a pretty well received point and click adventure game.
Did they? I know Goner was pretty rad.
Goner is really cool, like action platformer, really beautiful, really like almost like what if crayons could glow in the dark and you drew them on a black background? Like
it's like Space Funeral Spelunky.
Yeah, ish.
Kathy Rain is also awesome.
I haven't played Kathy Rain.
Yeah, that's the adventure game. Yes.
So briefly, can I spin this out a little bit? Which is
please.
Later this week we're going to do like a pre-E3 podcast, and we're going to talk about what we expect to see from companies like Sony and Nintendo and Microsoft and Activision, all these big companies. What do we expect from independent games and small games from E3 this year? Because over the last like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, there's been this steady increase in the place that independent games have as not necessarily showstoppers, but secret favorites or eye catchers. You know, you think about something like Cuphead, which still isn't out yet.
Still like, an indie favorite at E3.
Totally. Yeah. Like one of those things that's like, oh man, or Below, which still isn't out yet.
Yeah.
But like every year.
Granted, at least like Below like went away. Like they published a blog post and said, like, we don't know when this is gonna ship.
Right.
We'll come back when we've got more to say.
So like what do we want to see because this shouldn't be part of that conversation later like this week, but we have a lot to talk about as part of that conversation and a limited amount of time. So let's use this little moment right now that we've stumbled into to talk about independent games at E3. Like, do people have thoughts about the state of what indie is at this point?
I mean, it's consistently the one of the only parts of the sort of big publishers, you know, splash reels that I get excited about at this point. It's like, oh, that looks colorful. That looks interesting.
Right.
You know, when you see something like a Cuphead or a Below or something.
What's the last time one of these is one of the things that's been like part of a showcase? That's been like, this is an indie. This is we support indies here at company, and then like they turn back, and then there's like indies or the other thing, which is like the Ubisoft thing of like, we make games of all sizes. Here's our take on what an indie game looks
30
like.
30 seconds,
right?
Ubi art games. Yeah.
When's the last time that like one of those has really hit? Like indie art, like or Ubi Arts did Grow Home, which I loved.
Yeah,
obviously.
I love that game.
Well, what else?
That little war game they did was very good.
Yeah.
Oh, what
Valiant
was it called?
Valiant Hearts. That was great.
So
I love
Ubi
that
is actually hitting it on these small game
things. Yeah,
for real. But what about the other ones? Like, what have there been other big successes?
I got
that
excited
have come
about
out of?
Where the Water Meets Wine. Is that what it's called?
Where the water
comes from.
Full
wine.
Full disclosure: I wrote for that game, so I can't say anything good or bad.
I guess we can't talk about that then.
No. But what was that at? What show was that on? Was that like
couldn't tell you exactly which publisher's thing. I just know, like, oh, a thing that piques my interest.
Right.
I get excited about this thing. I see certain colors. I see certain signifiers that I know are meant to be exciting to me.
Yeah.
And I get excited about them. Like,
I'm just trying to think of, like,
puppy.
Like, yeah, it's good to know yourself, Danielle.
You know?
I feel like I'm waiting for one of those, the ones that we just mentioned, Cuphead or Below, or, like, what was Yarny? What was the Yarny game that EA made? Was that just called Yarny?
Was it just Yarny?
All I remember was that article, Fuck Yarny. That's literally
the only thing. That's all I remember, too. Burn in Hell Yarny, I think. It was like Unraveled.
Unraveled.
That's the name of it. Yeah. AKA Burn in Hell Yarny.
Like
the sequel. Yeah.
I don't know, like, y'all have covered games for a long time, but I just kind of generally want to know where you, what you feel about independent games being at E3 and what their place ought to be at this point, and whether or not that show gives them the space they need to actually find an audience.
Well, I think, you know, one of the, you know, many reasons that Sony's seen so much success relative to Microsoft in, you know, sort of this sort of console cycle is, like, you really felt at their press conferences that they gave, like, if not equal, like, relatively equal presence to independent developers, and were celebrating those games and were putting them right alongside your Uncharted's and Last of Us and games like that. And that it's, like, when those things appear at those big moments, these big, you know, bombastic productions in which, like, it's one of the few times when you have, like, the CNNs of the world sort of turning their eyes to games, like, it's in some ways a projection of values for the platform holders and what they consider important. So it's like, if this massive event that you have all the eyes on you, like, if you're taking time to highlight these smaller games, like, it says something about you and the values you're trying to sort of instill or project about your platform. And I think Sony very successfully did that with a lot of independent developers for years in a way that Microsoft, I'm not saying they ignored them, but Sony was able to capitalize that on in a way that was very successful both for their image and I think also reflected their policies for the kinds of games they were signing up and trying to make, you know, a very important part of the PlayStation platform. On the flip side, it's also, like, really encouraging to see, you know, last year at Microsoft's press conference, they had Steve Gaynor on stage to talk about his new game. It's like, that's, like, he's there because Gone Home was a big success, especially relative to its size. Microsoft took notice and said, we're going to put this team's next project, up on stage alongside a new Call of Duty. And, like, that's important. Like, that's meaningful. Even if sometimes it's just, you know, words as opposed to, like, actual practice with policy. Like, that makes me happy to think that and to see that those games are being put up there. It's like, this is also, capital I important.
Right. I'm curious to see if that there's actual material, like, effect from putting someone like that on stage. When that game drops, like, there are going to be people who know what Tacoma is because they saw it on an E3 presser that they would not have seen otherwise.
Yeah.
Rob, you look like you had a thing.
Well, I think, like, a game like Tacoma is kind of it's in, as my grandfather would have said, it's in the catbird seat when it comes to... Look, it's something my grandfather said. It's in an advantageous position.
It's about The Last Guardian.
Because
The Last Guardian was in development when your grandfather was a young man. No, I understand. I put it all together.
Wait, was your grandfather the little boy from The Last Guardian?
He was, exactly. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Sadly, Grandpa passed before The Last Guardian came out. But then again, lots of people passed before The Last Guardian came out.
Jesus, right?
Tell me more about the
entire
catbird
generations
suit.
Were consumed before The Last Guardian was released.
Oh my God.
How many wars did wait, now I'm curious. When was The Last Guardian? Okay, I'm not going to.
I think it was announced in 1939.
Okay.
And it was going to be the hit of the 1940 World's Fair.
Yeah,
and right, of course.
It just kept slipping.
They had to go to a new platform.
So, you know, I think, but with a game like Tacoma, it's like that's a big indie, right? That's like the triple A of indies. I think so. Like, taking a publisher like a Raw Fury, which I think is maybe trying to go in a little bit of a Devolver direction in terms of, like, a branding exercise. I think the problem a lot of indies are facing is that there's this incredible glut of games hitting Steam, and so now the publisher's role seems to have shifted a little bit in that it almost feels like publishers are fulfilling their traditional role of promotion and marketing, but it also kind of feels like there's an element of curation happening with some of these, like, indie publishers where, like, if a game comes to you from one of these publishers, somehow you get a sense that it has this kind of identity, right? It's going to be this kind of game or this kind of, like, production value. It's not quite like Nintendo seal of quality, but it's something that... These indie publishers are necessary to help a lot of the games that they're publishing stand out from a market that has basically become chaos.
And they theoretically actually provide service, too, in terms of QA testing and marketing support and, like, helping give feedback on some basic design stuff. That's not nothing. Like, when I talk to people who do that sort of work for independent developers, you can see what benefits come from that sort of publishing relationship. And I say that as someone who also really values the rough edges of work that comes from a place that has no publisher support. Like, so you know, I think that if you're making a commercial game, I hope that we see more of those small publishers in this space who are really talented at providing that sort of help and service.
Shout out to Adult Swim on this.
Adult Swim has done great stuff in that space. Totally. Totally.
So
my other thing here with indie games this year, indie games, quote, just imagine I always put scare quotes around indie games because I know it's a contested like term.
Yes.
I know that it's like
independently developed video games.
Independently developed.
Always remember that Valve is an indie.
Right.
So it's
right.
Like,
so it's a useless term in some ways.
Right. It's why, you know, it's useless by like a specific definition. It's more about sort of like describing a style approach. Like it's an imperfect definition.
Or a smaller team.
It's
maybe.
It's a term that we use in relation to something else, which is publishers who publish dozens of games every year or whatever.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Or platform holders or whatever. I'd argue that maybe Steam is a platform holder at this point. Anyway. I'm curious what VR looks like coming out of E3 this year for a similar reason, which is like a lot of small developers have thrown their money and also some VC money into VR.
Oh, sure.
Chasing being the hit, being the one that makes someone finally go out there and drop $800 on a Vive and Vive controllers and blah, blah, blah. And I'm really curious to see how many of those are on the floor. I know that there are definitely people who've reached out for us for meetings and some people who showed up at pre-E3 week. I know, you know, Oculus had some stuff to show off at the pre-E3 week. So I don't know, I feel a booth, though. No. Mm-hmm. They're doing behind-closed-door stuff.
Yeah, but I think it's...
That's a difference.
It says something about how the first roughly a year has gone about VR that they don't have a booth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And I'm curious. Yeah. I'm definitely curious to see what... if Sony has just been sitting on a bunch of VR games or, you know, this E3, I think, for VR, especially PlayStation VR, is sort of like the litmus test of, like, is this just like every other accessory Sony has ever produced in which it gets, like, roughly 12 months of support before it just kind of disappears into the ether?
Yeah.
Because their first original game post-launch, Farpoint, which is a game that I intended to write about because I thought, oh, like, I'm super into VR, and it's a sci-fi game, and they built this whole gun accessory for it. Like, it's not good. Like, it was, and they're charging near full price for it. I think $50, and it is not a $50 video game. It makes me nervous because like what was exciting about Sony getting into that space of like committing to VR was like I loved all the smaller independent stuff that was being made, and still love all that stuff, but the prospect of like Resident Evil 7s, like that's I wanted more of those, like giant resource intensive big art teams doing like just wild stuff in VR, and RE7 was like this really amazing opening gambit for that, and Capcom really committed to it and did a really great job with it, but like I can't think of what's on the horizon that is anything similar to that, and it's not going to shock me if Resident Evil 8, whatever it turns out to be, decided not to do that because I don't know
if it was worth that
investment.
Yeah, it's Horizon actually. Next on the horizon,
Horizon Zero VR.
Vero Dawn. It's a strange pick, let me tell you.
Vero Beach.
What's going on besides E3? Because like my brain space right now is like E3 booking and figuring out like media plans with production and figuring out which you know things we're gonna shoot our little like back and forth about hey you played a game with robot dinosaurs in it what was that like Patrick or whatever the games are this year I don't know what games are but what else is happening besides E3 because that's where my head is completely at.
Monument Valley 2 came out today.
Monument Valley 2, okay,
it's very exciting.
How's that going?
I started it. It's really beautiful and good. And the only main difference that I can tell so far from like 30 minutes with it is that you play as two little characters to do all your little twisty puzzles.
Wait, is it Monument Valley, TOO? Like Monument Valley 2.
2. I think it's just the number. Roman numeral 2.
Roman
numeral. I could
numeral.
Be wrong.
Not even Arabic.
Here, we can check actually. I've got this great
app. Live right
I've got,
now
I've
to
got a
iOS.
Good app right here. No, just 2. Monument 2.
Well, go to the title screen. I don't care.
Well,
what
that's
the
not
app
the
title,
title screen. That's a 2.
That's
a 2. Just the
it's like stairs that look like a 2.
Numeral 2.
All right, numeral 2. How is what's tell me about?
If you didn't play the first game,
something. Yeah. I didn't play the first game.
Oh.
When the first game came out, I didn't have a smartphone.
Okay.
Tell me about Monument Valley.
So it's a very chill and very pretty puzzle game.
Is it going to be in House of Cards again?
Is it going to be House of Cards
in again? House of Cards again? There's like a whole House of Cards episode about the first Monument Valley.
I don't have that information.
Okay.
Although Robin Wright was great in Wonder Woman, but anyway, okay. That was my connection today. Did you like that one?
Uh-huh.
All right, Monument Valley is a very chill and beautiful puzzle game in 3D space, where you are controlling a character and you're tapping, mm-hmm. and you are sort of moving the scenery around, sort of M.C. Escher-like weird staircases that are coming from impossible angles and so on and so forth, and you twist them around so that your little character has a path to the end. Mm-hmm. There's other twists on it, but generally that's how it works, and this is a continuation of that beautiful and chill and nice little game.
Cool. Maybe I'll check it out.
It's pretty cool.
I was bummed because I missed like the expansion they sold for a day.
Yes.
It's like the
it was
red
part of raising money for like Apple does a thing every year. For,
yeah.
AIDS research, AIDS awareness,
or something like that. And they only sold it for a day. I think it was only like a level or two. It wasn't a whole lot, but Monument Valley is it's like nothing revelatory. It's just really nice and pleasant and enjoyable. And I'm very excited that there is a second one. I'm going to save it for my upcoming flights, but I'm definitely psyched to check it out.
Someone in chat just told me that Agario is in House of Cards also.
Really?
That game about being a little circle that eats bigger circles, and it's a big multiplayer thing. It was like very big with kids last year with the kids. It was a 2016 Spinners of
Frank Underwood.
I don't know. Weird. Okay.
Oh, that's
cool.
I wonder what
game will be in the next season of House of Cards.
Horizon Vero Dawn.
I have an update.
Oh, shit.
Okay. So, one of the people who works for the publisher on Tormentor x Punisher are, does this game have a goatee reference on purpose? Gate? Does it have a goatee?
Does it have a goatee reference on gate? Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, mm-hmm. People are talking about it.
live from the streets, Patrick Klepek.
So, one of the people who works for the publisher said, hey, like, thanks for writing up this nice write-up about our game. But he's referring to the tweet from Waypoint and not my tweet. So he didn't get into addressing the central question. And so I responded and said,
classic
David,
dodge. Good.
Yeah.
David, is that a Goatsy reference? And like, just I needed to just get to the point.
You used his first name. That's a tactic. Yep. That you can get right into him.
And
say their name.
He replied, and David said, I asked at one of the developers the very same thing, and he has denied it since day one. And then I responded to both of them and said, send me a fucking email. We are going to figure out, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And so they're going, and they faved it, so I'm pretty sure that means they're going to send me an
email. That's serious.
Unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
Breaking news.
Breaking scoops.
You're on the... We can't use scoops in this one...
this one context. But I think it might be breaking scoops to do that.
It is.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I'm just imagining that scene in All the President's Men where it's like, you got Patrick on the phone being like, if this is a Goatsy reference... Say nothing.
Say
nothing. For 10 seconds. Do you understand? Like, so... Is this a Goatsy reference? Long pause. He's like, I've got it. All right. Uh-huh. Going to the presses. It's Goatsy.
It's confirmed. The headline's going to be report, colon.
Oh.
Game.
Report, colon. I think a semicolon is more appropriate, actually, to be honest with you.
Bob.
We're all going to get fired.
Jason Robards comes storming into the newsroom. God damn it, that has nothing to do with Goatsy.
Zavi says he really wants you to get to the bottom of it. He really wants you to get to the bottom.
I'm trying to get to the bottom.
Oh, boy.
All right. Huh. We should go to...
Oh, you want to put your hands in the question bucket?
I just want to...
Deep Throat's like, I was at a party with Haldeman, and he said, watch how far I can stretch this thing. The trick is that you don't care.
It's Mondays, which means we skim from the top of the question bucket instead of digging deep into the bucket.
From the top? Okay.
We're going to go...
I tore my headphones to their thing by accident.
This one comes in from Dash from Texas, who says, hey, Waypoint people, what's your workflow like? Well, Today's a hell of a day to ask that. What programs do you use, and what kind of order do you put your work in when writing a piece? Do you write things down on a million different pieces of sticky notes and paste them around your room with pictures a la Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia? Is that supposed to be italicized or underlined? I don't always recall what I'm supposed to do with titles. Or do you have everything digitally across multiple Word documents or use OneNote or what? I wrote a 60-page thesis for my college major and had 120 Word documents where I would write something, then open another document to rewrite. And I'm curious what someone in a less absurd situation might do. Patrick, how are you going to get to the bottom of this? What sort of note-taking are you using in the Goatsy Gate? Sorry, it was not just Goatsy Gate. I don't think that they made Goatsy for real Gate or some bullshit.
Good.
So I have actually spent I need to sit down. It's been long enough that I need to re-examine my process. For most stories, they're pretty simple. It's like interview either through email or a transcript that I've written up in this case a Google Docs document, because we're often because we all work together, having a shared document is easier there for editing purposes. I usually just have one document. I have two monitors on my desk, so I have one document on my left monitor and one document on the right, and the left is the transcript and or the email exchange, and the right is what I'm.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Writing, and that works pretty easily for stuff that is like relatively simple and you're not sifting through stuff. But the thing that I probably need to look into, and I haven't done it as much, is to actually – there is like software that is like better at like dealing with like tons of information from multiple sources rather than like having to tab through all of them. I've been told about that in the past, but it would definitely improve my personal process. And I do have a regular notebook that I use for when I'm playing games or I'm in an interview. Even though I could do a lot of that stuff digitally on my phone, it brings me great pleasure to like look at the stacks of notebooks I have like in my closet and like just to as a sort of like a historical document of things I was thinking about or working on, years and years and years ago. And then also there is just something about the permanence of writing it down that it tends to stick in my mind better than if I'm tapping down a phone or a laptop.
Sure.
So it's like if it's not something I need to like turn around very quickly for some breaking news story, which is not really the case with stuff we do at Waypoint. Like I tend to prefer using a notebook for sort of getting
your your loose ideas. Yeah, totally. How about you, Rob? What's your process look like?
So when I'm doing like really research intensive stuff, like I will say something like Scrivener is a godsend.
Yeah.
I wish I'd had Scrivener when I wrote my senior thesis in college, as opposed to carrying bundles of index cards around everywhere for each chapter.
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah. So Scrivener basically, it is sort of a word processing editing program, but it's also meant for like working writers doing really research intensive stuff, so that you can like append to any section of what you're writing all the secondary materials that you're going to need. And so Scrivener is really good at, in the main like frame, you're just typing your document, but then you've got basically like tons of panels that you can open up and unfold into sort of your research materials, right? So you can have basically in another tab, threaded groups of research materials that are relevant to the exact thing you're writing.
So like you have PDFs of books that you're referencing, or downloaded text from a web story that you're quoting from, or audio files, like all sorts of stuff that you just have in the sidebar connected to the sections that you want to actually – like you might need to reference them, you know?
And it makes it really handy to treat the stuff modularly. A really frustrating thing when you're working on something long is eventually you realize that a particularly useful quote or section is in the wrong place, or it needs to be put somewhere else. And it's really easy in the process of editing just to delete that stuff, and then you'd sort of need to go and like gather the materials again and rewrite it in a different section, because it's more than, like, let's say it's more involved than just a copy paste. It's really easy in something like Scrivener to have sort of the relevant argument sort of set aside outside the main document with the connected resources, and all that lives apart from the thing you're actually writing. And so it makes it really easy to get that 10,000-foot view of the thing you're writing, as opposed to the way you can get lost in line edits.
It is, like, the nerdiest shit, but, like, thinking about Scrivener makes me miss writing long, long, long things, because I like the process. I like the process of writing. Like, I love – Patrick has said a thing over and over again, which is, like, a project of his this year, is to turn me into a blogger. Yep. He wants me to just write as quick takes, Austin. Like, you
I'm
have
going
an idea.
To break you.
You're
going to
break my stupid, like, 1,500 minimum word count. I write shorter things than that these days. But – I do have a deep joy in writing really long things. Yeah. I haven't done it really since I left my PhD program, where I was writing, 30, 40, 50, 60 page papers and essays and research projects and all that sort of stuff. And there is something you get out of like laying something like that out and like wrapping your head around a really complex question and not having to do the thing that you do in 600 words or 2,000 words, which is you have to say, is that true? I can't address it here. I don't have the word count. I have to bracket it off and pretend that it's settled, even though it's super not settled.
Yeah.
I'm just going to write indie games. I don't have time to do 10 pages about what an indie game is and what the history of the term indie games is. But in an academic setting, you can totally do that.
Nice.
Or in like a really long-form journalism sense, right? You can say, let's actually – the Halo oral history is a really good example of this. Let's really get into what happened with some of the Halo side projects and the Halo movies and the Peter Jackson game that was supposed to happen. You don't have to throw that stuff out. It's a big project. You can spend the time laying all that out, which can give your reader that 10,000-foot view that you normally can't give them in 200 or 2,000 words or whatever, right? That's all. All I want to say is, Rob, you talking about Scrivener has made me want to do
it's
a longer
excited.
Project.
Oh, I stopped using Scrivener when I was doing shorter pieces because it was like, time to take my Ferrari to the grocery store that's one mile away.
Totally.
It's important.
Scrivener is to, even for shorter pieces, I haven't used it in a long time, but when I did mess around with it, like, it was useful for, like, sometimes you'll be writing a piece and you hit some writer's block, you're not quite sure how to form something, and so you'll skip to, like, I'll, like, work out, like, something that's for 3/4 through the piece that I haven't gotten quite there yet, but I don't want to have that paragraph just sitting there.
Yeah.
So you can, like, put it to the side. It's like, here are elements of the piece that I'm going to bring back into the piece instead of, like, hitting enter 50 times to, like, shove it away. And so just be able to, like, put material aside that is relative
or
to related to the
piece. Jamming it in an email draft.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Where, like, all the stuff
that's
where I'm like,
thing.
Oh, that's really good. I don't want to lose that.
Or a scrap
Google autosaves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am now thinking about using Scrivener to do tabletop role-playing game prep because I'm thinking about the ways in which it would help me organize a bunch of stuff, and that sounds really good. Anyway, Danielle, how about you? What's your process? I'm curious because you've also done, not for us so much, but in the past have done lots of video work.
Yeah, tons
I'm
of
curious
videos.
Like how you organize like your materials around that stuff.
Yeah. That's what I have my sort of formal training in. So I was always taught I use Premiere for any video or audio stuff. Even if I'm doing audio stuff, I still use Premiere and Audition to do like all the cleanup stuff. And I was always taught like bins for everything, bins, bins within bins, organize the shit out of everything.
Is a bin like a bucket?
It's a bucket.
Okay.
Yeah, you can call it, you can think of it as the bucket for video.
Okay.
And all different art assets and naming everything like incredibly, incredibly detailed names when you have like video clips, when you're importing those into a project saying like, A cam this or like this shot or this is what happens here. Obviously with games, it's more like gameplay of Lara Croft jumping off a cliff, whatever. Like I actually like put like a descriptor for like the most interesting action of that clip, that sort of thing. So yeah, just being so completely anal about there we go.
Oh my god.
All right.
You can't escape.
I guess we should
do the next
question.
I use Google Docs. I think of phrases and write them down in a Google Docs. And then I think of different phrases and write them down.
Yeah.
And then that's like what my lifestyle has now allowed. But that's my answer, basically.
Yeah. Lots of Google Docs.
I throw a lot of stuff out. Is like the most important lesson is like anything you read of mine that's 1,500 words was once 3,000 words, and 1,500 words of it's just gone because it was not
you
worth.
Snipped it and trimmed it down to its most crystallized
or
form.
Just cut it, just like the fuck out of
like,
your
this
final
good,
600 words
forever.
Peace.
Yeah.
That's always my number one piece of advice. All right, next question. A lot of these questions are like professional or like built around like our work processes or like stuff like that. So I'm just going to read this next one. This one comes from Hunter. After 2 years pursuing a major, I ended up at a school I ended up hating. There we go. I've decided to take a year off and reassess everything and try to be a writer. My question is a two-parter. How did the writers of Waypoint improve their skills as writers besides writing? And did anybody at Waypoint take a year off of school? I did. I dropped out of grad school twice now, I guess, right? So the first time was when I was in my master's program, my first master's program in philosophy. Dropped out, like, before I even really started. Second time, now. Second time, PhD program, $6,000 semester. I'm not paying $6,000 a semester for not even being on that campus and not having time to work on my dissertation. Bye.
I didn't stop, but I did transfer during grad school, which is an unheard of thing.
You
like,
can't
nobody's
do
ever
that.
Fucking heard of that.
That's
so.
A thing people don't know. If you're thinking about going to grad school, you have to understand, going to grad school is not like going to undergrad where it's just basically the same thing everywhere. Every grad school has like weird requirements for graduating where they're like, they need you to have taken these three specific courses.
Pretty much everything there. Only like six of my 40-something credits transferred. So I basically had to start over from scratch.
So do research on wherever you're going. Not
exactly.
That you didn't. Not that you didn't.
No, I did. It was just, you know, a disaster. But it's fine. It happens.
How have you become a better writer over the years?
Oh, God. Well, just, you know, the thing everybody says is always do it every day, which I know and you already know. This person knows that. But that is important to reiterate. And also read a fuckload of stuff that is not like the stuff you want to write.
What's an example of that for you?
So if you want to be a good critic, you should read a lot of fiction. You should read a lot of things that are not just criticism. Like do like an 80-20. Like definitely read the type of thing that you want to be writing in so you can be conversant, but always, always, always look outside of that so that you are not a frankly boring person who is always kind of writing the same exact things everybody else is writing.
Are there examples of like specific things you read as writers that helped push you to be a better writer?
Sports
criticism,
mostly sports
journalism
stuff.
Is actually a really great answer. Actually,
like I know, I learned how to use a semicolon by just reading how other people used it. For some reason, that didn't like solidify in actual school. Like if you asked me the mechanics of using a semicolon, I hadn't picked it up, so I never used it, which was inelegant because it is a useful tool. But then I just read enough that I intuitively picked up, like, oh, I get how this sentence construction works. And it was, like, through reading that I intuited how a semicolon works. And, like, you pick up on stuff like that by reading a lot of, like, good writers and reporters is that you actually, like, unconsciously pick up on techniques or consciously in that case, like, pick up on techniques that you'll end up using even if you don't end up realizing that you are using it. I would echo a lot of what Danielle said. Like, my advice to a lot of people is usually, like, if you want to write video games, like, go read film criticism. Like,
please,
it is really important, especially just because if we're talking in video games specifically. Like, it's just so young, and criticism is so young and reporting is so young in video games. There's just not a lot that's good. And there's a lot, whereas in other mediums, there's like a long history of like really interesting criticism, reporting, and analysis that like that gives you often like games writing reporting is more like aspirational and it is getting better and more interesting and more diverse, whereas other mediums have more of that already, and so it's often worth looking to that to get a sense of like what you'd like to do to make, you know, that side in video games better.
Yeah. How about you, Rob? So has there been anything that's like this shaped your writing in a specific way or helped push you?
So, echoing everything you guys said, read a lot. Definitely recommend read sports journalism and sports reporting. Weird thing, like David Halberstam, one of my favorite historians, it's good to look at him because the interesting thing that David Halberstam does throughout his career is he alternates between like business stories, political and military history, and then really detailed sports stories. And that's that's his oeuvre. And there are threads connecting it, but I think the really cool thing about looking at his work is the skills he brought to one exercise, he definitely then brought to the next, and all those skills were useful. It's worth looking at. I also got a lot of really good instruction in school. Like, I mean, I had found a couple professors who went to a small liberal arts school, so I wasn't just having a TA sort of grading my paper along with like 400. I would have a couple professors who really sort of took me under wing and really just went hammer and tongs on a lot of the drafts I sent in, and I got beat up a lot. But it also forced me to really confront all those times you think you're making a cogent argument and you're being intellectually honest and clever. It sometimes helps to have someone point out to you that, like, oh no, you completely failed to do that. here are the seams. Here are the things you try to paper over, and here's where it actually breaks down.
That's actually a huge one, is like actually find people who will read your stuff and push back on it. One of the things I can say this now is, like, when I think about my early time, or kind of like my middle career as a critic, like when I kind of tried it again after doing some grad school, there were definitely people who I had really antagonistic relationships with in the critical sphere of games, like essaying, right? Like, games criticism is filled with like lots of little petty beefs. Over attention, because they're just like, when you're young and trying to get attention for it, there isn't a lot to go around. And so, for instance, like, who appears in a Patrick Klepek worth reading column, like, can start some weird quiet beefs that are really strange.
I sure remember some of that, yeah.
But some
that
of the push
thing?
Oh yeah, dog.
It was a thing.
When it's like three people wrote about the same thing, but Austin got picked.
Yep.
Totally. And we're like, we didn't know each other at the time. But yeah, totally.
No. You're a
but that's
king
the sort
maker,
of thing where it's
Patrick.
Like, okay, who, which take becomes the take that gets passed around?
Right.
Multiple
yes,
people are trying to tackle
happens.
A thing.
Yeah.
And so, but in retrospect, a lot of those relationships were like, I'm not like here to be like rah rah competition is the best way to become a good whatever. But having people who would read my work critically and almost antagonistically forced me to step up my game. It's why I have not – it's why I write seriously about race, and I write seriously about race because I need my shit to be watertight. Like, I can't –
Yep. Sorry.
We're back.
Oh, yeah. Damn it.
The other one I want to say is hip-hop. That's the other one I want to say. Hip-hop is something that has, like, given me a great understanding of cadence. And a lot of not just cadence, right? Like, poetry is the other one here, right? Like,
yeah.
But hip hop specifically has been like, how do I say something that impresses people with words they understand, right? I can call someone unctuous all day, and like there was a sort of reader who would be happy to hear me describe someone who I don't like as unctuous. And I'm happy to impress them when I use words that are like that show some deep vocabulary that
sure.
reference that I've read a lot.
What does unctuous mean?
It's like
obnoxious,
like elitist, stuck up,
simpering.
Yeah. A little brown nosing.
Simpering's
a great
yeah.
word. But like, I like those words. I love it when someone says simpering. But what hip hop reminded me of is like, oh no, most people have a very familiar vocabulary that they use every day, and yet, like. When you know, Kendrick Lamar puts together a really powerful set of lyrics, there is an emotional response that is, like, very powerful, that is stronger than some deep pool, like, than some deep vocabulary,
right.
like, lesson, right? And so, like, that's a big one. The other thing is just, like, the other thing that hip-hop taught me was just the ways in which you can change up your flow to make a something punch really hard. There's this piece. This is not about hip-hop at all. This is from an American, like, a literary writer named Gary Provost called This
Gary's
Sentence...
Gary's not a rapper?
Not a rapper. Gary Provost, not a rapper.
All right.
Called This Sentence Has 5 Words. And
yep.
Have you read this before? Are you familiar with this? This is, like, my favorite thing because it communicates... poetically and with cadence what the task of writing well is. I'm just going to read it because it's not that long.
Yeah.
He writes, "This sentence has 5 words. Here are 5 more words. 5-word sentences are fine, but several together become monotonous. Listen to what is happening. The writing is getting boring. The sound of it drones. It is like a stuck. It's like a stuck record. The ear demands some variety. Now listen. I vary the sentence length and I create music. Music. The writing sings. It has a pleasant rhythm, a lilt, a harmony. I use short sentences, and I use sentences of medium length. And sometimes, when I am certain the reader is rested, I will engage him with a sentence of considerable length, a sentence that burns with energy and builds with all the impetus of a crescendo, the roll of the drums, the crash of the cymbals, sounds that say, listen to this, it is important. So write with a combination of short, medium, and long sentences. Create a sound that pleases the reader's ear. Don't just write words, write music. And it's like, oh, right, that's the thing. That's the thing that, like, I stay up late trying to fucking do is, oh, this sentence doesn't sound right. And I often don't have the language to explain to somebody what our jobs are when yeah. we say we write. But that's the part of the job is like, eh, the preposition's in the wrong place, but I can't quite say that. Like, I don't know it. And you just, like, bang your head against it.
Yeah.
One weird writing like tick slash technique that I have is that I often find it's very easy to get too colorful and write too many words, and like part of like maybe it's part of my habit is like doing a lot of sort of like bloggy posts, but like one of the things I do is like if I go like three or four words over onto the next line, like as a general rule I yeah. probably use too many words like in any given paragraph, like in as part of an elegant way of like getting a phrase
like a quick,
or an
yeah.
idea out. And so I will, like, if it depends on your monitor, but like on my monitor and whatever monitor I'm writing on every almost every single line, unless there's no way I can make it work, I will remove words and rephrase things elsewhere to get that line to go back up and move it back. Because I find, like, generally speaking, I could phrase something tighter, I could right. take out words, and so I just presume every time that I've done that, and any time I have a line that goes over, I presume there's got to be a way I can make that better and
tighter. Punchier.
And so, yeah. I've always wondered if someone's – like no one ever notices it, so I just assume it's like a monitor thing that like yours doesn't show up that way, right? Like right. it might actually go over the line on your monitor as opposed to right. mine, but on all of mine, like all of my stories, universally, every time, with like some only
that's
rare exceptions,
really interesting.
Line up formally, like across the board, because I just use that as a technique to try and make my
keep
writing
keep yourself
better.
From saying like. Far Cry 5 is a game in which, you know, that it tries to tackle the subjects of blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, just focus in on that. Like, what's
yes.
Far Cry 5 do? Far Cry 5 tackles. It's not a game in which blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Far Cry 5 does a thing. Like, boom, hit it, move. And that's a hard thing I took creative writing classes for years. I took English courses for years. No one ever fucking taught me how to do that necessarily outside of finding it in my own practice.
Adverbs are another thing.
Yeah, I defend adverbs. An adverb. I don't know.
They're good. I once
You're
learned
right.
that, like, they're very good, but, like, pick, like, your three favorite ones in a given piece. Like don't go overboard. Like, cut a couple.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, yeah.
don't overly trim, but, like, yeah, well, just take the little garden shears.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you didn't need that leaf right there.
Right.
My favorite thing on adverbs is Stephen King and On Writing, where he's like, look, like adverbs are like dandelions. Like, you see one in your yard, and you're like, oh, that's really pretty. Look how adorable that is.
Exactly.
But if you don't deal with that problem, if you start, like,
well.
Letting too many adverbs hang uh-huh. out, eventually your piece is going to be, like, fucking covered in them.
Totally. Totally. In general, I like rules that have that sort of vagueness and blurriness where
yes.
you can find your balance that helps you find your voice. That, like, the same way that, like,
writing is not math.
Right. Totally. Like, there is a place in writing for passive voice. It's often – but you better be fucking knowledgeable about when you're using it. You better
yes.
be like, I want to use passive voice here, instead of like, I stumbled into using passive voice because it was 2 a.m. when I was writing this and it just came out this way and I left it there.
Yeah.
Can I talk about how much I just hate, like, whenever you see people being like, oh, don't use this word. This word is dead. Don't use this voice. Like, this – like, passive voice is
yeah.
never tolerable. Like, look at all these passives.
I cannot stand
that stuff.
Finish it.
Well, no, because I can't.
I think dead
stuff.
Language is a thing. I think dead language is a thing because, like, I think that there's stuff that has completely. I don't use problematic. Problematic is dead language at this point.
Yep.
I have to be more specific than that. I don't evoke anything in anyone who reads problematic. I don't evoke anything in anyone who reads anything. Anybody who reads visceral. If I describe a game having visceral combat, it does not make them feel the way 10 years ago someone felt when they heard the word visceral in a game review. And so it's not. You're right. It's not bad. I'm not like never use it ever. But like
have
know
a
what
damn
that,
good reason.
Have a damn good reason.
Yeah.
I'm with you with voice though. Voice or stuff like. Language is just like words is just the one for me, but I'm with you with voice. I think there's room. Do you have an example of something that you that people say is dead that you don't think is dead, Rob?
No, I mean, but it's not. But it's not a question of dead. I just don't buy it. Like, I think the thing is, like, problematic now for you needs to exist behind glass. Like, you need to think about, like, when is problematic going to be relevant? Like, it's actually the word that I can that I'm searching for. And to use another word is to somehow misstate the situation. I think visceral is still a really useful word. The thing is, the thing that broke it was that everyone was calling things visceral that just that just weren't.
Like, totally.
And a lot of times, like, it was just, it, you know, there were a lot of hacky uses of visceral. But don't go around telling writers still finding their voice.
Oh, I'm not telling other writers.
That's what I can't stand.
I'm telling it when I'm editing them, and I've read a sentence, and they think it's a haymaker, and it's a jab, because they've said, and unlike other games, Hotline Miami's combat is visceral. Like, no, fucking go to sleep. Go away. Like, come back. Like, sleep on that. Find – replay that game. Pretend that you haven't read the last 20 years of games criticism that uses the word visceral as shorthand for something else that you mean, which is like – I don't know. Like, describe the actual experience to you and find something that's like a little bit more direct of what that thing is and find something there.
I definitely had a banned list when I was doing reviews editing, and it was a very short list. Visceral was on there, but it was only – it was like, if you're describing viscera,
right, if you're describing,
viscera,
right, if you're describing viscera
actual
cleanup
body
detail,
parts that have come out of a cavity. Yes, that's fine.
That's viscera. That's literal viscera. Yeah. Or if you're and I'm fine with stuff that's like a stretch that is metaphor, that is analogy, that's simile. Like if you're using words that evoke a feeling in the reader that you intend to evoke, even if that word has been somehow made cliche, or if it's a word that they never hear. Like, it's some comparison that you just never actually get. But it's just like, I don't know that. And there's some that are in the middle ground, which is like, I still have a hard time talking about controls in a way where I don't wind up saying that they're tight controls. But I've also heard that phrase a billion times, but I know what it means. So it's like, it's in that middle zone.
It's somewhat
useful,
but it is overused.
Right,
like
totally.
The word gameplay, which like both says something and says literally nothing.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Totally. I don't know. I mostly use this for myself. I'm not going out on Twitter and being like, don't read that person's reviews. They said visceral. Like, fuck off, Austin. Don't do that. That's old Austin. That's read more Austin, and I've gotten away from that.
All right.
You know? So,
All right.
That's – yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I actually didn't get to in that last episode when we talked about that analogy or that story in my life was like – as a writer, I was also that person. Mm-hmm. And like getting away from that – and then figuring out how to like bring a little bit of it back in was how I ended up being like an okay writer, like a writer people wanted to read, and not just a writer who wrote like he wanted to be someone who people wanted to read.
Right.
All right.
Be
your best self. Find your style.
Yeah.
So that's my advice for this person who wants to be a writer is like all the stuff we just said, mix it up, but then also ignore as much of it as you can and find the thing that's like that gets you to actually write.
And also probably do something for money.
Yeah.
Isn't writing, but that gives you the, if you possibly can, gives you the brain space for writing.
And also don't publish any, for the most part, this is another one, it's like not an absolute thing, but like don't let some guy who has a like gameblog.de like
gameblog.goatsy.
Gameblog, yeah. Don't give gameblog.goatsy.
Breaking news! I'm not going to read this email I just got because it's going to go in a story I'm going to write. But I've got an answer. And the answer was the designer on this game. He bolded the word honest in this. So you know he's spitting fucking
Patrick,
truth.
Patrick, say nothing. If okay.
10 seconds.
Honest is bolded. Also is the answer and their explanation.
Okay. See that. So, can you put that up today? Can we turn this around? I know it's late.
Today. Tomorrow.
Fuck. Okay.
All right,
I already put
morning.
One article about Tormentor X Punisher today.
Okay, fine.
Wait, I don't know if I can handle it.
And a Yoko Taro interview.
And a Yoko Taro interview, which you can go
Patrick's
read.
Patrick's been busting his ass today.
Waypointadvice.com. Yeah. I was going to say something else, and I lost it. It's okay.
Fine.
It's okay. Whatever it was not important.
It was about jobs while also writing.
Don't fucking convince – don't let anybody convince you to not get paid.
Goatsy Blog.
Don't let Goatsy Blog – don't tell me, I get lots of readers. No, Goatsy Blog does not get lots of readers. Yeah. Not enough for you to not get paid. If they're running ads, don't let them.
Right. If it's somebody's tiny journal that they're literally not running ads, they're actually not
making
money.
Or it's like
there are
spaces in which that's fine.
Yes.
But I've seen too many writers get taken advantage of to work with people who cannot benefit them in major ways. Well, own your writing if you're going to do it for free.
Also,
unless it's the biggest site in the world. Yeah.
I mean, the other issue is that
even then,
if money isn't changing hands, things can get weird. Of that professional professional contract is to keep things professional. And one of the things that is helpful if an editor is paying you is that they also get to say, fuck you, I'm paying you money for this. You're going to do
better.
It this way. Yeah.
Right. And also, if they're paying you, they are paying you, which means that they are invested in making sure that whatever you turn out is worth the money they're paying you.
Yeah.
And they will give you their resources and time to make you a better writer, because otherwise they're wasting their money.
Yeah.
So
yes.
I'm not saying it needs to be the most money of all time. Like when I first was starting, I was getting paid between $20 and $50 for 2,000, 3,000 word articles, which is not enough money.
So you worked at Game Shark too?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I wasn't there. I was another place that I love to death and still recommend new writers to that doesn't have a huge freelancer budget,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So like but even that little bit, even that like, hey, here's enough money to order a pizza tonight is enough to make that a professional relationship.
Professional writer.
Yep, totally.
Exactly.
So look for those places. There are lots of places that will pay you some amount of money. The second you feel someone is like, "Oh, you're doing it but do it for the love of it." Like bounce. That person is not there to help you.
Yeah.
They might think they are. They might be there to help you. They're not going to help you. I think that's an important distinction.
Right.
So, all right. I think that's going to do it for us. If you have questions, you can send them to us at gamingadvice.com. You find everything we do at waypoint.advice.com, digitalpyramids.com,
channel.
IRC channel, waypoint IRC.goatsy.cx. That one's not real. That one's not real. But you can find us on Discord
and on
Discourse, which is our form software. You can go to discourse.zone for that one.
Hell yeah.
And find a link to our Discord chat, our fan chat, somewhere on the forms. What else? People can find us on Twitter, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice. Where can people find you, Danielle?
Danielle R.I. on Twitter.
Rob Zachney.
At Rob Zachney.
And Patrick Klepek.
Like, find me spitting truth about Goatsy at Patrick Klepek on Twitter.
Yeah. Find me at Austin_Walker. As always, thanks to Bowen for letting us use his track. Miss you off the EP Pale Machine. Pale Machine.
Yes.
Is that a good... Pale Machine. You can find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Find me at Austin_Walker. That's going to do it for us on this Monday. I got to admit, when I tossed to you earlier, Danielle, somewhere deep in my brain, I was like, oh, it's Friday. It's not Friday.
Yeah.
But even though it's Monday, what do we say?
Be good. Be good at it.
Peace.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.